KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Kilmore Abrego Garcia, the Maryland man who was wrongly deported to El Salvador, is back in the United States.
He faces federal criminal charges related to transporting undocumented migrants within the U.S.
It's Friday, June 6th, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Coming up, the Labor Department itself is short on labor. That means routine price checks on goods and services may not happen.
The price of apparel, televisions, appliances, so on. Having less data at this time is not ideal.
Then to Puerto Rico, where ICE raids are raising questions about racial profiling.
80% Dominican is black. That's why they go to the racial profiling. Again, these people, because they're black.
Also, the Supreme Court has restored Doja's access to Social Security data.
And the rock band Turnstile's new album, Never Enough.
First, the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Hurst. Five leaders of the far-right Proud Boys extremist group, convicted of felony offenses in connection with the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol, are suing the Justice Department. The men, all of whom were granted clemency by President Trump, claim they were victims of a corrupt and politically motivated prosecution. NPR's Ryan Lucas has more.
In their lawsuit filed in the Middle District of Florida, the five Proud Boys leaders say that their constitutional rights were violated by the Justice Department and the FBI during the investigation into the January 6th attack. They allege that they were victims of systemic abuse to punish and oppress political allies of President Trump. They are seeking $100 million in punitive damages in their lawsuit. Four of the men, including the group's leader, Enrique Tarrio, were convicted at trial of seditious conspiracy and other crimes in connection with the violent attack on the U.S. Capitol in 2021. The fifth was found guilty of multiple other offenses. Trump pardoned or commuted the sentences of all of them on his first day back in office. Ryan Lucas, NPR News, Washington.
The explosive internet feud between President Trump and Elon Musk over his signature policy bill has appeared to calm down for now. NPR's Stephen Fowler has more.
After Thursday's dramatic meltdown of the billionaire bromance, the vibe now is more like new phone, who this? President Trump made the rounds calling reporters at prominent mainstream media outlets to say he's moved on from Musk and won't speak to him. Musk has been uncharacteristically quiet online, making just a few posts about his companies. The blow-up stems in part from Trump's so-called Big Beautiful Bill, chock-full of Trump's agenda items, including tax cuts, but that experts say would increase the federal deficit by trillions over the next several years. Stephen Fowler, NPR News.
The Trump administration is asking the Supreme Court to step in and allow it to continue dismantling the Department of Education. NPR's Corey Turner has more.
The administration needs the Supreme Court's help after a federal judge in Massachusetts told the administration to reinstate the nearly 1,400 employees it has already put on leave on the way to firing them. The judge's concern was that the department, at roughly half its former size, was failing to perform important duties. In its request for the Supreme Court to intervene, the Trump administration argued, quote, "The Constitution vests the executive branch, not district courts, with the authority to make judgments about how many employees are needed to carry out an agency's statutory functions. It's not clear how quickly the court will move or what it will decide." Corey Turner, NPR News.
Wall Street higher by the closing bell. All three major indices up around 1%. You're listening to NPR News from Washington. Hundreds of veterans gathered on the National Mall in Washington, D.C. today for the Unite the Veterans rally, protesting the Trump administration's cuts to the Department of Veterans Affairs. Chris Purdy is one of the rally's organizers.
One-third of federal workers are veterans, so when we see cuts to the federal government, the workforce, that's going to disproportionately affect the veteran community.
Thousands of VA employees and health and benefits opted to retire early instead of being laid off. Taylor, Texas made history in 2021 when it hosted the area's first in-person Pride celebration. But this year, Taylor's new mayor refused to issue a proclamation recognizing the annual event, surprising the city's LGBTQ plus community. Kaylee Hunt of member station KUT has more.
Taylor Pride will hold its fifth annual Music and Arts Festival on June 28th, despite Mayor Dwayne Arriola's decision not to recognize it. Past proclamations have not only recognized the nonprofit's annual festival, but also its contributions to the city's LGBTQ+ community. Taylor Pride board member Denise Rogers says the organization is determined not to let the mayor's decision affect its celebration.
Our community is resilient. We've never needed anyone to officially tell us that we exist or that we can celebrate queer joy. And so we're going to proclaim Pride Month in our own way.
Arriola did not respond to KUT's request for comment. I'm Kaylee Hunt in Austin.
And I'm Janine Herbst, and you're listening to NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Kresge Foundation. Established 100 years ago, the Kresge Foundation works to expand equity and opportunity in cities across America. A century of impact, a future of opportunity. More at kresge.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. The Trump administration used to insist that it did not have the power to bring Kilmar Abrego Garcia back from El Salvador after they wrongly deported the Maryland man to a prison there. Well, today, Attorney General Pam Bondi had this announcement.
Abrego Garcia has landed in the United States to face justice.
He's going to stand trial in Tennessee on charges related to a conspiracy to transport people in the country illegally. NPR immigration policy reporter Ximena Bustillo is here to discuss this development. Hi, Ximena.
Hey there.
What does the indictment against Abrego Garcia say?
A grand jury in Tennessee returned a sealed indictment charging him with alien smuggling and conspiracy to commit alien smuggling. Attorney General Bondi said that the U.S. presented Salvadoran authorities with an arrest warrant for Abrego Garcia, and they agreed to return him to the United States. She said that the grand jury found that over the past 9 years, Abrego Garcia played a significant role in an alien smuggling ring. The indictment alleges that he made over 100 trips transporting people without legal status between Texas and Maryland and other states. Abrego Garcia's lawyer, Simon Sandoval Moschenberg, told me that after months of delay and secrecy, they were bringing his client back, quote, not to correct their error, but to prosecute him.
Now, this is a very complicated case. It's gone all the way to the Supreme Court. What are the most important things for people to understand about how we got to this point?
The reason this all really came to the forefront is because Abrego Garcia had received protection from removal to El Salvador in 2019 by an immigration judge. That protection, known as withholding of removal, had never been challenged by government officials. But the Trump administration deported him to El Salvador due to an administrative error, and there he was put in a notorious mega prison. The U.S. admitted to this mistake quickly, but justified it by accusing Abrego Garcia of being a member of the Salvadoran MS-13 gang, which the Trump administration has also designated a foreign terrorist organization. Abrego Garcia's lawyers dispute that he's a member of the gang, and he didn't have a criminal record, and his lawyers quickly sued the government to return him to the United States. U.S. District Judge Paul Azzini's in Maryland then ordered the government to facilitate Abrego Garcia's return, an order unanimously upheld by the U.S. Supreme Court. Judge Zinis has been maneuvering a months-long legal case over this deportation, and the Justice Department, which was defending the administration in court, had tried to invoke state secrets privilege to withhold information as well.
So how did Attorney General Bondi explain that the administration had previously claimed it could not bring Abrego Garcia back to the United States? What changed?
Right. The Justice Department officials were asked about this today, and here's what Deputy Attorney General Todd Blanche said.
The reason why he is back and was returned was because there's an arrest warrant, which was presented to the government in El Salvador. So there's a big difference there. As far as whether it makes the ongoing litigation in Maryland moot, I would think so, but we don't know that. This, you know, he just landed today.
Bondi said Abrego Garcia would be tried and if found guilty would be sentenced and be returned to El Salvador upon the completion of that sentence.
NPR's Jimena Bustillo, thank you.
Thank you.
To the economy now, because it is the time of the month when the Labor Department reports on the nation's job market, and the department itself is feeling the effects of federal job cuts. This week, the Labor Department said staffing shortages have forced it to scale back the number of price checks it conducts in putting together the monthly inflation report. NPR's Scott Horsley is here. Hey there, Scott.
Hi, Mary Louise.
Okay, so what exactly is going on here?
Yeah, the inflation report, you know, makes headlines just about every month. We're going to get the May numbers next week. And behind that report, there's a small army of government employees who go out and check the prices of gasoline and groceries and rent and lots of other goods and services all over the country. It's a very labor-intensive process. And economist Omer Sharif, who heads a firm called Inflation Insights, says the government typically checks about 138,000 prices every month.
You've got people going into grocery stores scanning prices. You've got people going into retail stores and scanning prices.
Lately, though, because of a government hiring freeze, there haven't been enough federal workers to do all those price checks, so they're having to make do with less. The Labor Department says it's scaled back data gathering all across the country, and it stopped checking prices altogether in Provo, Utah, Lincoln, Nebraska, and Buffalo, New York.
So to the question of why this matters, do we know how this would affect the inflation numbers that you're often here reporting on?
We don't really know. The government says it should not affect the headline inflation rate, but some of the regional numbers or the prices reported for particular items could be more volatile from month to month. There's no reason to think this will produce a report that's consistently rosier or more worrisome than it should be. But because the underlying data is sketchier, the readings will be less reliable. And Sharif says that's unfortunate at a time when we're all watching to see, you know, how the president's tariffs and other policies might affect the cost of living.
We're kind of heading into this period where the teeth of the tariffs is probably going to hit a lot of different components. You know, the price of apparel, televisions, appliances, so on. And having less data at this time is not ideal.
It's a little bit like the National Weather Service cutting back on the number of balloons it sends up to check the temperature and the wind speed at various altitudes. Maybe that doesn't matter so much on a calm, sunny day, but when there's a potential storm on the horizon, you want the best information you can get.
That's so interesting. I just had no idea there was this small army of people, as you put it out there, doing all this. How do people use the information that these price checkers gather?
Well, there's all kinds of practical ways the inflation yardstick can affect people. You know, obviously the Federal Reserve watches this closely when it's deciding where to set interest rates. Some rent increases are automatically tied to the inflation rate. And Social Security recipients get an annual cost of living adjustment that's based on the inflation rate. So Sharif says the Consumer Price Index doesn't just measure the economy, it can actually move it.
It's hugely important to get that right and be as accurate as you can be.
Now, according to the Labor Department's job tally, the federal government has cut almost 60,000 jobs since the beginning of the year, with more cuts on the way. Those cuts are supposed to save the government and the taxpayers money. But this is a reminder there is a price to be paid for that, and it's another price we might have a tough time measuring.
And Pierre Scott Horsley, thank you.
You're welcome.
Never Enough. That is the name of the new album from the hardcore rock band Turnstile, and fans cannot seem to get enough of the group from Baltimore. Last month, they played a raucous free concert for thousands of fans at the city's Wyman Parkdale. Yeah! Izzy Bavis from WTMD in Baltimore was at the show, and this week she joined NPR Music's New Music Friday podcast to chat about Turnstile's new album and how they have kept their hometown roots while becoming one of the biggest rock bands in America.
It's a really big deal for the hardcore scene as well as just music in Baltimore. You know, Turnstile has been making music since like 2010, and they've put out a handful of projects, and this one definitely feels the most introspective. Never let you go down, anywhere you go. In the I particularly love the song Look Out For Me. It has this very kind of admirable nod to Baltimore in their music video, or like the movie part of it that they're doing, as well as the Ode to Baltimore Club at the end of the song, which is one of my favorite parts of the record. The thing about Turnstile and like the longevity of their career and the different projects they've made is that Never Enough and their last album Glow On is like them kind of stepping into a different role than just like we're a hardcore band from Baltimore. They're definitely like stepping out. I really want to talk more about Dreaming, which I just think is this song that when I was listening for the first time to the record, I was like, what is going on? Because you have these horns, and then it just like kind of builds and builds and builds, and the song just takes you on this sonic journey that made me like realize that Turnstile is not afraid to take risks, even now that they have like, you know, more commercial success. Like, they're still experimenting and trying different things, and I feel like Dreaming is a great song for them to try that on. Turnstile, it's so apparent in their music, it's so apparent in the way that they talk about Baltimore, but they love Baltimore. They love this city, and that is a huge part of being from Baltimore and living in Baltimore is loving it and being able to, you know, go off and make these amazing records and go and play these huge sold-out shows and then come home and hang out at Auto Bar and, like, go to Sophomore Coffee. Like, and that's so apparent when I went to the free show at Wyman Park Dell. And you have kids there, you have families there, you have people who are, you know, coming in from D.C. or coming down from Philadelphia. And it really shows that how much that they care about music. Like, they're not doing this just so they can, like, make a new album. Like, they're doing this because they love what they do and they want to put their heart and soul into it. And I think that's really apparent with what they did on this album.
That was Izzy Bavis from WTMD in Baltimore, and you can hear more on NPR Music's New Music Friday podcast. Turnstile's new album, Never Enough, is out today.
Thank you for listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Wallace Foundation, an independent nonpartisan research foundation collaborating with grantees and partners in the arts, school leadership, and youth development. More at wallacefoundation.org. From Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, at wtgrantfdn.org.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. In Puerto Rico, recent ICE raids have mostly rounded up immigrants from the island next door, the Dominican Republic. Dominicans have long lived in Puerto Rican communities but are often not citizens. The arrests are part of President Trump's mass deportation campaign, and they're forcing Puerto Ricans, who are U.S. citizens, to confront the prejudice their Dominican neighbors often face. NPR's Adrian Florido reports from San Juan.
Standing in front of her house in San Juan's biggest Dominican neighborhood, Dolores Espiritu Santo says she is now always on the lookout for ICE agents.
¿Tú te crees que son poquito? Son muchos. Oficiales.
You think there's just a few, she asks? There's a lot of them. She is from the Dominican Republic. She's dark-skinned. But she says it's not her color and features alone that make people assume she's not from here. There are many black Puerto Ricans. She says it's her features along with her accent.
Por el acento. ¿Tú me entiendes?
I've lived in Puerto Rico so many years, she says, but I still say things like a Dominican does, like,
oh, pero mira.
When I speak is when people know I'm not Puerto Rican, she says. And she says that is the problem right now. She worries an ICE agent will see her, hear her, and ask for her papers. She goes to her car parked on the street and grabs a sheet of paper off the passenger seat. If I show them this, they have no right to take me, she says. It's a copy of her U.S. passport card.
Americano.
Espiritu Santo became a citizen years ago, but she knows that if an immigration agent stops her, he might not believe she's here legally.
Y se lo presento. ¿Me entendiste? Porque uno se pone nervioso aunque uno sea legal.
When they stop you, you get nervous, she says, even if you are legal. ICE says it's made about 500 immigration arrests in Puerto Rico since Donald Trump returned to power. 75% of them have been Dominican nationals. They've been detained at workplace raids, but also when ICE agents roll into neighborhoods looking for people. Dominicans fear their dark skin and distinctive Spanish accent are making them easy targets. José Rodríguez leads the Dominican Human Rights Committee, a local advocacy group.
80% Dominican is black. You know, that's what they go to the profiling, the racial profiling, against these people because they're black.
He's been monitoring ICE operations in Dominican neighborhoods and says a pattern is becoming clear. Agents have approached groups of black people gathered on the street, heard their accents, and asked for papers. Some with legal status have been arrested because they weren't carrying their green cards and only later were released. ICE has acknowledged this.
Eso quiere decir que sí. Hay un profiling, un perfil racial en las intervenciones. Estamos en un barrio.
Rodriguez says there's only one reason legal residents doing nothing wrong are being detained on suspicion of being in the country illegally, because they're being profiled.
I don't agree with that at all. That would be very irresponsible of us to intervene with individuals just because they have a Dominican accent.
Rebecca González Ramos is a top ICE official in Puerto Rico. She runs its investigations office, known as HSI. She acknowledges her agents are approaching people on the street. She says they're often looking for a specific person with a deportation order, but will question others and ask for their papers. She denies, though, that they are racially profiling.
Especially here in Puerto Rico, we are of all colors. So moving on accents and moving on people's color, you know, it's first of all, it's illegal. And second of all, it's not the way HSI does business. We work based on intelligence and executing either arrest warrants or final orders of deportation.
She says the vast majority picked up so far have been Dominican because they're the island's largest foreign-born population. But the recent raids in Puerto Rico have forced both Dominicans and Puerto Ricans to confront an uncomfortable truth.
You see me with a white skin?
Nilka Marrero is pastor of a church that serves the Dominican neighborhood of Barrio Obrero. She's Puerto Rican, blue eyes, blonde hair.
I walk around the barrio. I have never been detained. No one even looks at me.
Dominicans have always faced racial prejudice in Puerto Rico, she says. But over the years, they've found greater acceptance. The raids have been a reminder. They still don't fully belong.
You're black, you walk as a Dominican man, or you look like one, I'm gonna snatch you.
It's forcing tough conversations with her Dominican congregants.
I've told them to try to mass, try to speak Spanish, Puerto Rican, not Dominican. Try to disguise themselves a little so they can pass unseen.
Do you have to braid your hair that way, she asks them. When you run to the store, do you have to wear that head wrap? She hates suggesting they hide the markers of their nationality, but she says, I just don't want them to get arrested. Adrian Florido, NPR News, San Juan, Puerto Rico.
The Trump administration has terminated hundreds of scientific research grants, but in a few cases, it has restored the funding. NPR's John Hamilton reports on how one scientist lost and then regained a $53 million grant to study a leading form of dementia.
It's called vascular dementia, and it can occur when a stroke or other condition impairs blood flow in the brain. It's the most common form of dementia after Alzheimer's. So in 2020, the National Institutes of Health announced funding for a 6-year study to understand how damage to blood vessels can affect memory and thinking.
It is the only study that has been funded to do that.
Dr. Charles DeCarli is the principal investigator and a neurologist at the University of California, Davis. He says the plan was to enroll more than 2,000 black, white, and Latino people, 65 and older, who had noticed a decline in their memory or thinking. The team would use MRI scans and blood tests to see if they could predict who would go on to develop vascular dementia. By March of this year, the study was about 2/3 done. Then DeCarli got a call from the NIH.
My program officer called me, and she had been told on a Friday, and she called me on a Monday to say that it had been terminated.
The official notice would come later.
It took a couple of days for us to actually get the letter because they send it to the wrong person.
The letter read like others being sent to NIH-funded scientists around the country. It criticized research programs that study diverse populations and said that the grant in question did not align with NIH priorities. DeCarli was puzzled. The NIH had insisted that the study include populations at high risk, and black and Hispanic individuals are at least 1.5 times more likely to develop dementia. What's more, DeCarli says, the study was fulfilling a congressional mandate to improve diagnosis and treatment of dementia.
The grounds of the termination notice were irrelevant to my study. And the lawyer's advice that I got agreed with that. And so we had more, if you would call it, leverage.
DeCarli and a team of academic scientists and lawyers spent 3 weeks preparing an appeal. And it worked. The NIH restored the funding. DeCarli recounted the experience at a meeting hosted by the McKnight Brain Research Foundation. Without the restored funding, the team would have been unable to continue tracking study participants. And DeCarli says that would have made it nearly impossible to determine who was most at risk.
But the ability to predict, because we needed follow-up, that opportunity would likely have been lost.
And millions of dollars would have been wasted. John Hamilton, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
Clerking for a federal judge might seem like a plum position for recent law school graduates, but NPR reporting has uncovered pervasive abuse of clerks by some judges and a culture of fear that prevents speaking out.
Most of the clerks I spoke with had maybe never before talked with a reporter.
I'm Scott Detrow. NPR's Carrie Johnson tells us how she got the story on All Things Considered from NPR News.
all things considered. From NPR News, I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Singer Marianne Faithfull died in January.
But not before recording a few last songs, a posthumous EP called Burning Moonlight.
One of the last times I saw her, I sort of said, oh, yeah, I wish I had the copy to show you. And she was like, darling, it's all about the journey, not the destination.
First, the news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. The months-long legal battle to return the man wrongly deported by the Trump administration to a notorious prison in El Salvador came to a dramatic head today. That's when Attorney General Pam Bondi announced that Kilmar Brego Garcia is now back in U.S. custody to face a criminal indictment. All this after the Trump administration refused to facilitate his return earlier this year, despite a Supreme Court ruling.
Abrego Garcia has landed in the United States to face justice. On May 21st, a grand jury in the Middle District of Tennessee returned a sealed indictment charging Abrego Garcia with alien smuggling and conspiracy to commit alien smuggling in violation of Title 8 U.S.C. 1324.
That indictment also states that Abrego Garcia was a MS-13 gang member, which he has denied. And his lawyer has previously stated that he saw no wrongdoing in footage released from a traffic stop a few years ago. The city of Portland will pay $8.5 million to the descendants of more than two dozen black residents whose neighborhood was destroyed more than eight decades ago. From Oregon Public Broadcasting, Kira Buckley reports.
In the 1940s, North Portland was home to a thriving black neighborhood, until the city used racist policies to displace homeowners. In 2022, over two dozen descendants filed a federal lawsuit against the city. Recently, the sides agreed to settle for $2 million. But at the city council meeting to approve the historic settlement, Councilor Loretta Smith motioned to raise it to $8.5 million.
Can I get a second?
Seconded.
Sounds good.
All 12 councilors voted to approve the settlement at the amended amount.
This is NPR News. Researchers say they've discovered seasonal patterns surrounding divorce filings. NPR's Vanessa Romo has more.
Kirk Stange is a family law attorney with 25 years in the business. Over that time, he's noticed that divorce filings hit two peaks per year.
Our business really picks up in the springtime, and then it tends to pick up August, September-ish.
The slow seasons, he says, especially December and January, then again in June and July, can mean a drop of about 50% in divorce filings.
We could spend money advertising and try to do things, but it just doesn't work.
A 2016 study from the University of Washington that analyzed divorce filing data also found consistent peaks in March and August. The study's author says couples likely put off legal steps because they're caught in a cycle of optimism tied to domestic rituals. And that keeps people hanging on for just a little bit longer before they finally make things official. Vanessa Romo, NPR News.
The White House says trade talks with China will resume next week after President Trump and his Chinese counterpart spoke by phone yesterday for about an hour and a half. China's President Xi Jinping called it a good conversation, but also acknowledged that trade talks had gotten a bit off track in the past week. Trump is sending the Treasury and Commerce Secretaries, along with the U.S. Trade Representative, to London on Monday to meet with Chinese officials. Stocks finished higher to end the trading week. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from this station And from Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. From Amazon Business, offering business buying services from office supplies to IT essentials and maintenance tools to help bring visions to life. Learn more at amazonbusiness.com. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. The Supreme Court has handed Doge at least a temporary victory. The team Elon Musk started can keep accessing information collected by the Social Security Administration. That includes Social Security numbers, medical and mental health records, and family court information. NPR Legal Affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg is here to tell us about what is turning out to be a regular Friday court special. Nina, what did the court do exactly?
In an unsigned order, the court temporarily overturned actions by two lower courts that had limited the Doge team's access to sensitive private information at the Social Security Administration. The High Court sent the case back to the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals in Richmond for a ruling on the merits of the case, which likely will take months while Doge continues to have access. The vote was 6-3, with the conservative supermajority ruling in favor of the Doge team.
Did the dissenting three liberal justices have anything to say?
Justice Kagan noted her dissent separately. Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson, writing for herself, and Justice Sonia Sotomayor blasted the majority for giving the Doge team unfettered access to unredacted personal information, quote, before the courts have time to assess whether Doge's access is lawful. In essence, she said, the government's so-called urgency about gaining this access, quote, is the mere fact that it cannot be bothered to wait for the litigation process to play out before proceeding as it wishes. Although this has not been the way the process has worked in the past, Jackson said, once again, this court dons its emergency responder gear, rushes to the scene, and uses its equitable powers to fan the flames rather than extinguish them.
Wow. Go back for a minute and tell us about how this case started. Where did it come from?
Well, on his first day in office this year, Trump tasked his newly minted Department of Government Efficiency with modernizing federal technology and software to maximize governmental efficiency and productivity. Acting Social Security Commissioner Michelle King initially blocked the Doge team from accessing confidential Social Security records. After a short time, she resigned rather than provide full access to the Doge team. Her replacement, Leland Dudek, then granted Doge what opponents called unfettered access to Social Security data systems. Labor unions and grassroots advocacy organizations sued. They were worried that the Social Security Administration was providing personally identifiable information to unauthorized Doge personnel, and they argued that by providing confidential Social Security Administration to Doge, Social Security violated the Federal Fair Privacy Act.
What does that law, the Fair Privacy Act, say?
The 1974 federal statute created a code for the collection, maintenance, use, and dissemination of personal records and information stored by the federal government. Among other things, the law requires that individuals provide consent before their personal records are shared. The Trump administration contends that disclosing secure Social Security documents is permitted through one of the Privacy Act's 12 exceptions. Agencies can share information internally when doing so is essential to performing official duties. Without access to secure records, the administration maintained, Doge would be unable to modernize the federal government's technology infrastructure and detect systemic fraud.
NPR Legal Affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg there on the Supreme Court handing the Doge team at least a temporary win. Thank you, Nina.
Thank you, Ari.
As the Trump administration steps up immigration enforcement, some ICE agents are encountering protests by bystanders. As NPR's Martin Costi reports, a couple of those confrontations have become heated. Protesters say ICE tactics are heavy-handed, while the government is warning the public not to interfere with agents.
There have been showdowns recently between civilians and ICE agents in Minneapolis, Chicago, and last Friday, San Diego. where ICE raided an Italian restaurant with employees that the government suspected of working illegally with fake documents. Angry bystanders swarmed the agents' cars, and agents used flashbangs to disperse the crowd.
It got out of control because of the way that they showed up.
Sean Ila Rivera is a San Diego council member. After the raid, he posted a photo of the agents on Instagram, calling them terrorists. That got him angry backlash online. But he says the purpose of that operation was intimidation.
They wanted to make a show of it, so they did it on Friday night at dinner time. They wanted to make a show of this, so they showed up with assault rifles. They wanted to make a show of this, so they showed up in far more numbers than they needed to. And the use of masks, I think, is incredibly concerning.
Masks have been a big issue for a lot of people, as more ICE agents seem to be hiding their faces with neck gaiters or other coverings.
I'm going to answer the mask question.
This is the acting director of ICE, Todd Lyons, at a press conference earlier this week about ICE operations in Boston. He says agents have been doxxed online and been the targets of death threats.
So I'm sorry if people are offended by them wearing masks, but I'm not going to let my officers and agents go out there and put their lives on the line and their family on the line because people don't like what immigration enforcement is.
At the same press conference, the Homeland Security Investigations Special Agent in Charge for New England, Michael Kroll, added this.
I caution those who try to impede or obstruct operations or those who dare to threaten or assault our law enforcement officers.
And he warned of potential investigations and prosecutions. Still, civil rights groups say bystanders have the right to observe, protest, and shout questions. Kate Evans is director of the Immigrant Rights Clinic at Duke Law. She says ICE agents don't necessarily have to answer questions from bystanders, but those questions can still be important.
I mean, they're essentially functioning as kind of Fourth Amendment observers and informing the people who are actually the subject of the seizure, the arrest, that they have the right to request a warrant.
ICE agents have to show a warrant signed by a judge, not just another ICE official, to enter private spaces without permission. But they don't necessarily need a warrant to arrest someone in a public space. They can often do that based on probable cause and the risk of flight. And these distinctions can be confusing. Also confusing, sometimes ICE agents take part in broader criminal investigations, which bystanders assume are immigration raids. That seems to be what happened in Minneapolis on Tuesday when crowds turned out to oppose federal agents who were searching a taco restaurant. Officials later said it was a criminal matter involving multiple agencies. Ryan Perez is one of the people who turned out.
The thing is, if you don't want to confuse people, why would you send ICE agents to the scene?
Perez works with a nonprofit called COPAL, which trains what it calls constitutional observers to monitor ICE raids. Perez says the group is cautious because sometimes people will issue false alarms about ICE raids that are actually something else. But at the same time, he says you have to understand people's response when heavily armed ICE agents appear on the street.
They intentionally brought armored vehicles in a residential area and a business corridor in front of like very high trafficked areas. That's a stunt to me.
And standing there on Lake Street in Minneapolis, Perez says the crowd's response to those agents felt a lot like the response to police back in 2020 after George Floyd. Martin Costi, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. As interest in women's sports soars, Major League Baseball is stepping up to the plate. For the first time, MLB is investing in a women's professional softball league. It launches tomorrow with a game in Wichita, Kansas, and another outside Chicago. NPR's Amy Held reports that fans are watching to see whether this effort will help equal the playing field.
In Montgomery County, Maryland, Little League girls are getting pumped ahead of practice. Kate Harding favors pitching. At age 10, she's already been playing softball for years.
I like all the action and the cheers.
Annette Roberts co-founded this league and coaches the Bruins, a team of 10 to 12-year-olds. She says the sport helps the girls build life skills.
They love hitting the ball hard and the joy they feel when they catch somebody at home plate on a steal. It's just, you know, giving them so many opportunities to see themselves as being powerful.
Now they have another opportunity to see powerful players. More than 60 pro athletes on 4 teams in the new Athletes Unlimited Softball League, competing across 10 cities this summer as women's sports keep growing. About 30% of U.S. adults now follow women's sports at the college or professional level, according to a new poll. And softball plays a part, with viewership in this week's Women College World Series averaging more than 1 million viewers per game. ESPN says that's a 25% increase over last year. And softball is returning to the Olympic stage at the 2028 Summer Games in Los Angeles.
It's ready for prime time.
That's John Patrikoff, CEO of Athletes Unlimited, the organization behind this new softball league.
Over the last few years, women's sports has received the attention, the distribution, the visibility, and more recently the marketing support that really is what's required for a pro sport to break through.
Major League Baseball is providing that marketing support and what it calls a substantial long-term cash investment in the AUSL. Some games will be broadcast on the MLB Network and ESPN. Other attempts at establishing professional women's softball leagues have struck out, most recently in 2021. Wayne McDonald teaches exercise and sports science at the University of North Carolina. The 4 teams in this league will be touring around the country without a home base. He says that's good for building grassroots support, but it'll take time.
In the past, it's been the whole concept of return on investment, and it has to happen immediately. And it's not going to happen in this case.
AUSL aims to become a city-based league next year and expand to 6 teams.
I think this is a very positive step for women's softball.
A step. Starting young, female athletes still face fewer opportunities on equal playing conditions and pay gaps. A report from UNESCO last year found about half of girls drop out of sports during adolescence, 6 times higher than the dropout rate of boys. Kate Harding, the young pitcher, says this professional league gives her hope for the sport that she loves.
Because, like, when you have a dream, like, to play softball, you don't want to just end it right after college ends because you don't have anything to go to.
A crack at the pros could give girls another chance to live their dreams. Amy Held, NPR News, Darnestown, Maryland.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Thank you.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. In the early 1960s, Marianne Faithfull was at a party eating hors d'oeuvres 17 years old when the manager of the Rolling Stones approached her.
Can you sing? And I said, I can, Yeah. And I think about a week later, I got a telegram saying, be at Olympic Studios at 2 o'clock. Such and such address, London. And that's where we did Tears Goodbye.
Smiling faces I can see, but not for me. I sit and watch as tears goodbye.
Marianne Faithfull talking with NPR's Scott Simon back in 2005. Well, she went on to record more than 20 solo albums. Marianne Faithfull died in January. She was 78. And in the year before her death, she was making new music, an EP called Burning Moonlight, tied to the 60th anniversary of her debut albums.
It's just the sort of mood I'm in, burning moonlight. Like fire, like food. Think about it as hard as you can.
Burning Moonlight is out now, and with me to talk about it is the album's executive producer, Andrew Batt. Hi there.
Hi.
It's a lovely album, and so I want to start by saying congratulations on putting it out in the world and also acknowledging it must carry such contradictory feelings for you because she's not here to watch you launch it out in the world.
I know. And just hearing her voice in your intro there was, you know, it caught me up a little.
Yeah.
It's I'm still getting used to her passing.
So let's talk about this new album, which I mentioned it's tied to the anniversary of her debut albums. It very much pays tribute to her roots, the pop roots, the folk roots, all the early stuff. It also can feel quite contemporary. I'm thinking of the song Love Is.
Love is where you leave it. Love is where you find it.
Yeah, well, that was the whole thing, is that, you know, Marianne wanted to kind of get back to work, and she had this idea that her last sort of written album, Negative Capability, was you know, as she always said, rather doom and gloom, you know, and she was the queen of doom and gloom, but you know, she wasn't really like that in the flesh, you know. She was very funny and upbeat and charming, and there was a whole other side to her, and a very romantic person. And her music was a great way to express her sadness and melancholy and all those things. If she'd been well enough, we would have done an album, but I think we had to sort of stick to an EP because it was all she could really cope with.
Love it, love it, love it, what you make it.
You know, Marianne's career began in such an unusual way. She'd had this hit with As Tears Go By, and of course Decca wanted a pop long player, but she had wanted to do a folk record because she was actually performing in the folk clubs around Reading, where she grew up, prior to her being famous. So in a way, the story that we hear in the beginning, in the intro with Andrew Lou Goldham, it's not the whole story. She wasn't a complete beginner when he found her. He made it happen for her, but she wasn't a beginner.
She was already on her way when she was nibbling those hors d'oeuvres at the cocktail party.
Exactly, exactly. And, you know, she basically, when Decca signed her, she sort of put her foot down and said she wanted to do this folk record. And amazingly, they agreed. And I actually can't think of another precedent where a largely untested artist had two albums out on the same day and in two very different genres. It's quite surprising.
Well, and it's amazing that here she was all these years, all these decades later, and she was still playing with both. She still had both the pop and the folk sides, and she was still having fun with it.
Absolutely, and she always loved folk music, and she always wanted to go back to it. Long before we did this, you know, she often talked about it, like, oh, I could do another folk record. And so we did, and it felt, again, very organic and very personal, because the songs we ended up choosing for the folk side, one of them was called Three Kinsmen Bold.
There were three kinsmen bold, and they fell in love with me.
Which was a song her father had taught her. He was very into music and collected songs and sheet music and played and sang himself. And so some of those folk things came from him. That's how she got to know them. And for the other track, the other folk one, we decided to revisit She Moved Through the Fair.
And it became the closing track.
It became the closing track, and it's so haunting.
My young love said to me, my brothers won't mind.
What is distinct about this version for those who haven't heard her earlier recording?
Well, I mean, so it's a cappella, which is as she would have performed it in the folk clubs back in the day. And it's a sort of ghost story almost. But it's also about love, you know, loss. And I think both of those things were very connected to her as a person, and she was very fascinated by them. And I think also she just enjoyed the melody line. It sort of sat very nicely in her voice, and she could create an effect with it.
She turned away from me and she moved through the fair, and I watched her so swiftly move here and move there.
Marianne Faithfull, she lived such a life. She had nothing left to prove to anybody. Was your sense that this last album, was it for her fans? Was it for all of us? Or was it, at this late hour of her life, was she singing for herself?
That's a good question, you know, because I think she really did it for herself. It was the journey of it, you know, that always interested her in a way. And she was always pleased when something went down well. I mean, in fact, one of the sort of sad things about this is, of course, she never lived to see the physical edition of this EP come out. And one of the last times I saw her, I sort of said, oh, yeah, I wish I had the copy to show you. And she was like, darling, you know, it's all about the journey, not the destination.
Andrew Batt, he is executive producer of Burning Moonlight, a new EP from the late singer and actress Marianne Faithfull, who died in January. Andrew Batt, this was a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
What does it mean? What's the plan? Is it what we say it? Is it right? I'm walking in fire, I'm burning moonlight. Burning moonlight.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Raymond James, a firm focused on transforming lives, businesses, and communities through tailored wealth management, banking, and capital market solutions. Disclosures at RaymondJames.com. From the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping someone else less fortunate is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at LodestarFoundation.org. From EBSCO, committed to upholding the principles of responsible research as they work to develop AI technologies to enhance research around the world. Learn more at EBSCO.com. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to power.
Treats me so unkind.